Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yes. Welcome to this edition of Meet the Press Slim, the third edition on the Social Suplex Podcast Network. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to re-upload every other episode of Meet the Press Slim from like 3 or 4 years. Luckily, I backed them up because I was smart enough to do so, because Shout Engine, my old podcast provider, actually shut down. So, wah, wah, there. But enough of that. I am here with a very special guest. He is a contributor at Voices of Wrestling, the great Voices of Wrestling site, and he's a host of the Emerald Flow Show on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. Gerard DiTrullio, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Danny. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm a little under the weather, but it ain't stopping me. I can speak in a low radio voice like this, you know, but we're going to talk a little bit about your fandom a little bit, where pro wrestling Noah and All Japan are going, because we haven't had that much coverage on the Social Suplex Podcast Network about All Japan or Noah, and just your impressions of wrestling, honestly. Where'd you get started?
So I guess my first memories of wrestling would have been in 1992, like I'm in Canada. And so like in Ontario, the big weekly show would air on Sunday afternoons on Channel 11 out of Hamilton.
Right.
And that was the time slot that Maple Leaf Wrestling and the Tunnies had for a couple of decades, and then WWF took it over. So like I would be at my grandparents for like the Sunday Italian meal thing and go over there like half an hour before we ate, kind of thing. And I would watch like wrestling challenge, I think it might have been.
Ooh.
With my grandfather.
Was your grandfather a fan? Or
I don't think so, but it was just on and he'd watch it.
It's one of those things, I remember, like, when my grandparents, my mom, she would just let me change the channel and just let me watch what I wanted to watch when I was at their house, and it was great.
Yeah. So most of my memories would have been, I don't know. I remember Bret Hart as the Intercontinental Champion.
Ooh.
I remember Papa Shango making the Ultimate Warrior puke.
That's an all-time bad one right there.
Yeah. And Undertaker putting in body bags, the jobbers in body bags.
Oh, yeah. That was so unique at the time, like Undertaker putting jobbers in like body bags. I'm like, you can't get away with that now. But boy, the Undertaker was very mystique back then.
For sure. Big Boss Man was someone I really liked too.
Ooh, yeah. Big Ray Trailer, God rest his soul.
So it's funny because, for a while there, WCW coverage in Canada was spotty, but there was a channel we got out of Cleveland that would air worldwide on Saturday mornings. And we eventually got TBS on like not premium cable, but for whatever reason, until like 1999, WCW didn't really interest me. But mind you, I regret that now. I wish I'd been watching WCW back in like 91 and 92. So that's, I guess, one of the regrets of my life.
Yeah. What are your bigger regrets as a wrestling fan?
Oh, that's probably my biggest, to be honest.
Ooh.
Yeah. Like, you know, I don't really have any other like super regrets. that like, no, I could, like of shows that I could have gone to but didn't, or stuff like that.
I've been to every show I wanted to go to.
The shows I could have gone, I wanted to go to, but I couldn't afford it or something at the time. I remember I would have been 17 and Muto came into Ring of Honor in Philly, I think, but that just wasn't going to be doable type thing for me. But I really wanted to go and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But so I can't tell you, because there was a number of years where I dropped off in the 90s. I couldn't tell you where it was. I want to say, when does Doink debut?
Doink debuts 93, 94.
Okay, because like I feel like Doink is around, but I don't remember. It's very early on, and I don't remember much of that, and I stopped watching.
Like, Doink, let me see. Doink the Clown. Doink.
Because I think I remember very early Doink, but...
the first one, Matt Osborne, right?
Yeah. Matt Bourne, yeah.
The Doink the Clown gimmick. 1992.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so that would have lined up.
Yeah, so he made his in-ring debut in 1993.
Okay. So I couldn't have been watching much past 93, and I fall off, although I kind of keep track and I know who the big wrestlers are because I read a lot of video game magazines back then.
Right.
So I would at least like, I would see Doink, I'd see like, I'd be like, oh, Shawn Michaels is like the champion now type thing, right?
Right. That's how you sort of caught up with it. Like,
yeah.
At the time where you weren't like really interested, like, how old are you now?
37.
47?
37.
I'm so sorry.
No, that's
I misheard you. I'm 26. So there's an 11-year gap. And how I got into wrestling was basically like UPN used to air SmackDown. So
yeah, I used to watch SmackDown. Okay.
So it was the old wrestling channel, honestly. In back in the old days, WP, I forget their call letters now. UPN 57 call letters in Philadelphia. That's now the CW affiliate. And then I was exclusively a SmackDown kid. You know, and then I went from there to where we are now.
Well, it would have been when you started watching, it would have been the better show, right?
Yeah, 05. 05 to 07. Yeah, SmackDown was the better show. I had no interest in Raw. I had no interest in the Reign of Terror.
Yeah. So, okay. So I stopped watching wrestling. I figure 92, 93, my grandfather gets sick and, you know, ends up passing away like in a year or two after. Right. So that sort of takes away from that. And, you know, but it wasn't like, oh, I stopped watching wrestling because my grandfather passed away. I just guess I never really had an attachment to it. Or as much as I thought I did or whatever. So fast forward through the early days of, I guess, the Monday Night Wars and the Attitude Era and everything. And I don't start noticing that wrestling is taking off probably until late 1998. That's when kids at school started wearing their NWO and Austin shirts. So I don't get back into wrestling until February 1999. Yeah.
So right after the finger poke.
First Raw I ever watched was the night after St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Wow. I don't even remember the show. I remember my first wrestling card.
I think it's a cage match between Rock and Mankind because they did the ladder match the night before, right?
Right.
And then the big show come, or Paul White came out because he was still Paul White. So I missed Goldberg or the peak of Goldberg. I guess that would be another regret, right?
That should be another regret.
Yeah.
Missing out on Goldberg.
Pete Goldberg, and yeah. Oh, I saw 1999 Goldberg. WWF. So I get back into it. I don't know what it is, but like I always fancy myself like an intellectual kid and whatever like that. But yet I still love wrestling. So I start watching WWF because it's hot. But then I quickly get into WCW. One of my first memories of WCW is that extremely convoluted tag title tournament in early 1999. And I'm immediately attracted to the team of Benoit and Malenko. And like, you know what ends up happening, but those were my guys.
The rabbit hole you go down once it's the Benoit and Malenko.
So I get into WCW and whatever. I mean, it wasn't the cruiserweight divisions wasn't even what it was in 98 by 99, but like Kidman was still doing good stuff. Blitzkrieg was there.
Blitzkrieg was incredible.
Yeah. You know, there was still good stuff with Hoovy and Ray, Unmasked Ray. I come into it and he unmasked that Super Brawl 8. Or nine, Super Brawl 9 or Uncensored 99, I think
it was Uncensored 99.
Mm-hmm. So
like we have these things even from before our fandom in the back of our minds.
Yeah.
And like it's so funny because I won wrestling trivia like a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And like a lot of the questions were like WrestleMania. So like 1 through 16.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what happens after WrestleMania 20. Like if you name a match.
Really?
Yeah.
I probably couldn't tell you what happened after WrestleMania 24.
Okay. Yeah. I've watched the last few WrestleManias actually. I probably watched more WWE. Well, I know I was watching a little more WWE like 2015 to 2017. But like there was definitely a time where I wasn't watching wrestling. Well, I was keeping up with Japanese stuff, but I wasn't paying attention to what was going on in America. So I was like, who the fuck is this Miz guy?
Yeah.
Why is he such a big star?
I saw the rise of that. That's the funny part. Yeah. That's a funny part because like 2006, 2007, you see the rise of this guy and then it's like, oh, he's going to be something.
Yeah.
He thicks out a little bit. And then, like, 2010, 2011 hits. And he's a star.
Like, yeah. Yeah, he headlined WrestleMania.
Headlined the WrestleMania. So, it's really weird. Like you thought this guy with the faux hawk was never going to make it. And he did.
Yeah. So I guess to get back to the timeline of my fandom. So in 99, right, I'm following wrestling, both WCW and WWF, playing a lot of WCW Revenge with my friends. And I'm playing, well, I never had an N64, I had a PS1.
Right.
But I was playing like GoldenEye and Revenge a lot at my friend's house, at friends' houses. And but I like playing WCW versus the World, I think it was on PS1.
Right.
And
boy, that rabbit hole it goes down. Mm-hmm. Like the flagship set this week.
Yeah. There is versus the World talk on the flagship. And so we have the internet. We got the internet in 98 in my family. So I'm using it to basically read about wrestling nonstop. That was my main use of the internet at this time. I remember WCW Live. I remember, and so I was never a big magazine guy, but this changed my life. I bought the 1999 PWI 500. And I want to say it was Austin number one, I think Goldberg number two or RVD number two.
I can actually look this up. PWI.
But I remember who number three was. It was Misawa. And there were pictures of him and Kobashi and Kawada and Muto in that. Because I really didn't know who the great Muto was in early 1999 because I like had just gotten back into wrestling. And I never watched WCW when he would have been there.
1999, it was Stone Cold.
Yeah.
RVD.
Okay, yeah. And Misawa was three, right?
Misawa, yeah. Rey Mysterio 4, Rock 5, DDP 6, Muto 7.
Yep.
Undertaker 8, 9 Goldberg, 10 Taz.
That's not a bad top 10 for that year, I suppose.
And that's not a bad top 10 at all.
Yeah. So
this was like almost at the end of peak Sawa right there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm like, these Japanese guys look very badass. And I was never a big, well, I watched anime, but not like a lot. Like, and I'm like a poser anime guy because all the anime I've seen is like the big stuff. Like right. Akira, Fist of the North Star, Full Metal Alchemist, Dragon Ball, that kind of thing. But I was a huge fan of Godzilla movies. Like I owned like all of the Godzilla movies on VHS.
You still own like the Godzilla movies on DVD?
I got the Criterion collection of the Showa era. It's awesome. And so I had like familiarity with Japanese culture, right? And I was like, well, they do things cooler in Japan. So I want to try to track more stuff down. So like I find like the Death Valley Driver.
That's a rabbit hole.
I was a lurker. I think I may have posted one or two things. I can't even remember what my username was. I started listening to Wrestling Observer Live on IATA.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
You're blowing my mind with all this stuff because I wish I was around during this time.
Yeah. It was kind of wild. I've gone back because people have uploaded those episodes to YouTube, like on like, you know, very important dates, like WCW gets purchased by WWF and that kind of thing. And
right. And the IATA show was up on.
Yeah. And I would listen live. I think it drove my parents crazy because I was clogging the phone lines for like 2 hours straight every night. And then we got TNN on cable in Canada. So ECW was big. And a big part of my fandom was seeing Masato Tanaka.
Yes.
And I watched him and the Mike Awesome when they traded the title back and forth. So that was huge. People don't remember this, but Akuto Hidaka was also on the same episode that Tanaka won the ECW world title on.
Akuto Hidaka, who did he face?
I can't remember. Was it Little Guido?
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah.
I think Akuto Hidaka had a handful of matches.
They would have been good guys to put together because Guido was in UWFI.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So... okay, so from there, I am like, okay, Masato Tanaka is fucking awesome. And like, he always has a very special place in my fandom because of that. And then from there, we're off. In 2000, I start getting tapes. First tape. Oh, you want to hear how I got my first tapes? Because this is quite the story. I don't order them through a website or anything. So I'm from London, which is halfway between Detroit and Toronto. So we do family vacations in Toronto, like on a long weekend or something, stay at a hotel downtown. So I go there and like, I'm reading on all these message boards, like, oh yeah, I would go down to the Japanese like grocery store and buy tapes, right? I would see a lot of people would do that. So I look up in the yellow pages, a Japanese grocery in Toronto, and I find one, like it's on the western edge of downtown, or it's not downtown,
but
like,
walk.
It's a 30 to 40 minute walk from my hotel. I go there. My grandmother had given me $60 for the weekend. I go in, I ask for the tapes. They had 15 VHS tapes at $4 each. So
what do you do?
I buy them all. And it was all Japan and New Japan TV from between 97 and 98 and 99. Cause I got like G1 97 was on there and episodes from the Baba Memorial Show in May 99 were on there too. And it was just random, right? So I then proceed to go return to the hotel carrying this, like, it's one of those wide boxes that's narrow. So it's just awkward to carry. Or, you know, it's like it's a long, thin box full of VHS, 15 VHS tapes. So it's awkward to carry. So I then proceed to walk back to the hotel carrying this box of 15 VHS tapes.
40 minutes. That's
and I think my parents thought I was crazy because I blew like all my money on that one thing. Exactly 15 tapes they were selling at $4 each. So it was like perfect luck. And what other things did I do? I did end up getting an N64 like when they were dirt cheap because they had sort of, you know, it was past the peak, right?
Yeah,
but to this day, the most expensive video game I ever purchased was Virtual Pro Wrestling 2. And I would have paid $120 Canadian for it in either late 01 or early 02.
What's that worth now?
Well, let me pull up the inflation calculator here.
I love how we're both big nerds and we're just searching things.
Well, no, sorry, my internet was bugging out there for a second. So as not to make this like bad audio or anything like that. But yeah, like
you want to know who was number three on the PWI 500 in 2005?
No, who?
Satoshi Kojima.
Ah, that's funny.
That's funny.
We mentioned that would probably that. That would have been his peak year, I think, too.
Yeah, beat all Japan here.
Yeah, because he won the Triple Crown in February 05.
He was ahead of Triple H and JBL.
That's hilarious.
Only behind John Cena and Batista.
So from there, I I'm spending money. I'm getting tapes and stuff like that. And
Van think you're crazy.
Yeah, but they don't like complain. They just think I'm crazy. They don't complain about it or try to stop me, although I'm like in my late teens. Not like they were gonna be like that strict about these kind of things or something like that, but it was just funny to they think I'm like, why is he spending money on these, like, you know, god, eighth generation VHS tapes and stuff like that, right?
There's a reason.
So $120 Canadian in 2001 would be $184 today.
Yeah,
I've never paid that much.
What's sense. Virtual Pro Wrestling 2 worth on eBay? You still have that game?
You know, I don't know what happened to it, and that drives me crazy.
Oh,
I moved a lot when I was like in university and stuff.
Yeah,
I would end up moving every year, like, oh, you know, stuff like that. So I don't know when I lose track of it. If it's anywhere, it's somewhere in a box in my parents' house, but I don't think it is.
$59.99 right now.
Okay, so the copy I got came with the back shaved off because, you know, the copy protection and everything.
Yeah.
So that was very convenient that I didn't have to shave it off myself because I probably would have fucked.
Somebody's selling one and two for $73.99 from Japan.
That's not bad at all. Because that was the second most imported N64 game, I think, of all time.
What? I did not know this.
Yeah. Second, or I think it's second. There was some RPG that was number one, I think.
Let me research this.
Yeah.
Most imported N64 games. Here we go. The old top 10 Nintendo 64 game. There you go. It was some RPG.
Yeah. But I think VPW 2 is number two.
Sin and Punishment. I'm looking at a different list.
Yeah. So I guess about that time, that sort of sets me up for my fandom. The only other big moment I can think of, you know, that the Muto and Kojima jump to All Japan was a big moment for me, actually, because 2001 Muto was a huge thing just for me.
Oh, yeah. It probably saved your fandom, sort of like.
Well, I wouldn't say it saved my fandom, but I was just incredibly into it. And that's why even to this day, like, Muto is in my top 10 all time. And I don't think there's anything he can do short of like, a terror, masterminding a terrorist attack or something that would have me remove it, even though I really don't like what's been happening. I just like can't remove the good year, the good times, and stuff like
that. No, we can't remove the good times with Mudo.
Yeah.
If knees are shot, but we can't.
So
you want to know how I discovered Japanese wrestling?
Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm curious how other people do it, because everyone seems to have their own weird story.
2009.
Unique one.
Guess what happens?
2009. Misawa dies?
Yep. I was like, who the hell is this Misawa guy? And why are they saying he's the best wrestler of all time? I go onto YouTube, which YouTube back then was the wild, wild west.
Mm-hmm.
Watch 120.97, and then I was like, I knew.
Yeah.
I knew right then and there. I was like, I got to watch more of these guys. But I didn't get a fleeting interest into Japanese wrestling until like 2014.
Okay.
With the big New Japan.
So, going off to university and stuff like that, changes some stuff. So I completely drop out of American wrestling, North American wrestling. And there's a few years there where I was really spotty in following Japanese wrestling, although I would still like watch the big stuff, because by then it was in the torrent era. Like I remember downloading I think the first torrent I ever downloaded was the 2005 Noah Dome show.
Ooh. And that's one hell of a torrent to download, the first.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Because no, I think I'd heard about torrents for a year or two before. And I was just like, I don't quite understand how they work. But eventually I figured it out.
My mom had a boyfriend who knew how torrents worked. And then I quickly picked up how torrents worked. And I downloaded indie wrestling from that.
So from 06 to maybe, I don't know, early 2010s, I am checking in and out. There were times where I was like going weeks or months without checking up what was going on. Right. And then I would catch up. So when Misawa died, I didn't find out until 3 weeks later.
How did you feel not finding out until 3 weeks later that one of your core idols had died?
It was gutting. Very gutting. Well, you know what? Because I had tuned out wrestling. You want to hear my Chris Benoit dies story?
I do want to hear your Chris.
Okay.
Benoit. I heard it in summer camp. That's how I heard it.
So I don't hear until I'm not following wrestling, but obviously it was a huge story.
Right.
But it must have been the Tuesday after or the Wednesday. I am, I'm at the University of Toronto. I was at the gym. Then I go to grab a drink at like the variety store at the northern edge of campus by the subway.
Oh no. Oh no.
And then I'm leaving. And because of the way they had the newspapers like thing, you don't see them coming in. You see them going out.
Yeah.
And he's on like the front page of the Toronto Sun, which is the tabloidy, like the New York Post or something. So they would run like a story like that as their headline.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I was like, holy shit. And I couldn't process it. I didn't have a smartphone. And I'm not even sure how many people had smartphones back then in 2007.
Like,
so I couldn't like Google it instantly. I had to go home. But I was like, I was literally in shock from this. This is wild. This is like one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
And he
know what? And it was mind-boggling. So I don't get on the subway. I just start walking home, which takes an hour to do. Walk across the
subway. You need to process this.
Yeah. And at the time I was a smoker. And I was just like chain smoking cigarettes the street trying to process like why did this happen? And it was insane. And then,
I found out about Benoit everything.
Yeah.
In summer camp. I get home from summer camp. And there was the news. And then I woke up the next morning And the Raw happened. I watched the Raw. Didn't know, obviously, what went down after the Raw.
Yeah.
And then I go to Summer Camp the next day. Somebody told me Benoit murdered somebody. I'm like,
jeez.
What the hell? And I was like, I was 11 at the time.
Right.
You couldn't, like Eddie's death was the first death really that hit hard. And then it was Benoit's because it was like, Jesus Christ. Even at 11 years old, you're like, bruh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had lived through quite a few wrestler deaths at that in that era, but nothing, the Benoit thing really shook me, right? And it's awful, but like not every wrestling death shakes me, right? I can name a handful, like,
right. It's only
Guerrero, Benoit, Misawa, and Atsushi Aoki.
Ooh.
In 2019. Yeah. Those are like probably the deaths that shook me the most.
It was definitely Benoit, Eddie. Those two, definitely. Because Eddie was early on in my fandom and I took a like to him right away. I knew I was smart right away, man. I gravitated towards Eddie and Benoit and all those guys.
Exactly.
I knew I was a smart right away.
And Malenko, I have to say, apparently, and I haven't seen too much of this, but I've been told that there is a backlash to Malenko claiming that he's overrated. Have you ever seen that?
He's not overrated.
No, I don't think he's overrated at all.
It's like this whole meta thing now.
Yeah.
And like, everyone's trying to be meta. And I'm like, I'm not about that. I watch the matches to watch matches.
Yeah.
But, and then like wrestler things that happened, speaking out was a thing that happened that really shook me. But it shook me in a different way. Like not to view these guys as great guys.
I never thought most wrestlers probably.
No.
Yeah.
No. I never thought that either, but
and I thought that from a very young age because I would listen to like the interviews on the Wrestling Observer Live because you had Tom Zank and you're like, this guy's a sleazeball, even though he was very funny and stuff like that, right? And then, you know, Sam Martino was on telling, he seems like probably somewhat of a decent guy, but he would tell stories about like, you know, all of these other awful people in wrestling and stuff like that,
right? And I had been backstage at wrestling shows and stuff like that prior and stuff like that, and I didn't know like the culture and stuff like that, so that's why it hit me hard. It was like, I gotta be more on guard.
For sure.
Like so that's how it feels. But those were the wrestling things that really hit you hard. And what other deaths were there?
Well, I mean, I would have been through Hennig and Hawk and
I didn't go through those.
Who else?
I went through Brian Adams.
I remember that. Benoit. Yeah.
And it was like the weeks after Benoit, I was like, one Warrior was one where.
Oh, Owen. I went through the Owen death. I can't believe I forgot that.
You went?
No. But like I was watching.
Oh, yeah. You were watching Over the Edge.
No, I wasn't watching Over the Edge. I watched the Raw after, though.
Oh, yeah.
But that was something that I lived, you know, experienced and everything like that, right?
Right.
And, yeah. So
it's getting too grim for me.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, like, yeah, I know it's grim and I know not everyone's going to want to talk about it, but I mean, I think it's something that we all have experienced as wrestling fans.
Yeah, and as music fans, as
for sure,
movie fans. Like certain deaths shake you. Like
I remember Kurt Cobain dying, but I was 9 years old, so I wasn't listening to Nirvana.
Yeah, Taylor Hawkins was a recent one for me. Like,
right,
I had to like stop what I was doing because Foo Fighters is one of my favorite bands.
It's funny you bring up we sort of shifted to music because when I would have been 12, 13, 14, 15, the Smashing Pumpkins were absolutely my favorite band.
Oh.
I would say I was a regular Pumpkins listener through the Machina album.
Machina, okay.
And do you remember when he released Machina 2 all online?
No.
Okay.
When was that? What year was that Machina?
04, 05?
No. I got into music more in like 2010, 2011.
Oh, okay.
Because I went to high school and like I discovered the active rock station in my city and started forming my own taste in like 2008 in middle school.
Yeah. Anyway, the point, what I was going to say was like, that was from 2000. Jesus, that was way earlier than I thought. Then, so he released, Billy Corgan releases Machina 2 all online because he's frustrated with the record companies and stuff. So I would say I'm probably a Big Pumpkin fan until maybe 01 or 02.
Right.
And then he goes, he does Zwan, he does his solo stuff, and I don't like any of it. It's not very good.
No, it's not. No.
So for him to come in and buy NWA and everything, like I didn't have any emotional attachment. I'm like, oh my God, Billy Corgan has bought this. I'm going, you know, I just don't feel anything about it.
I felt more attachment when Tony Khan bought it. Was going into the wrestling business.
Right, right.
Because yeah. I was like, finally, someone who understands me
mm-hmm.
buying a wrestling company.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it's finally after all these years of like people running us down, running the people who follow the Japanese wrestling tapes, people who are on DVD, VR, people who are on pro wrestling only, people who are on Voice of Wrestling down. A guy like us bought a wrestling company and he's doing pretty damn well.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And AEW's not
perfect. Death Valley Driver poster.
Death Valley Driver poster, Tony Khan. Yep. And it's not like AEW's perfect. It's not. Right. I went on Wednesday and I didn't like some of the show, but I felt like finally someone who gets what is going on with this industry.
It's funny because I watch every week. I've bought in just about every pay-per-view and I enjoy it, but it doesn't hit me like it does Japanese wrestling.
Right.
But I don't want to miss an episode of that. Seems weird. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird because he just has those instincts.
Yeah. Well, like for example, like I'm not going to sit here and bury Hangman Page, but he just does. I don't have that emotional.
No, I don't have that emotional attachment
that a lot of people do.
I'm like, I don't like, I like Kenny Omega. I like guys kicking ass. I like Brian Danielson. I like John
Moxley. It's funny because I never liked the Young Bucks for a while. I just thought it was annoying, but like I cannot deny their talent, right? They keep winning me over with every match and stuff like that, which is funny.
Yeah, it's funny because like they are good. They are genuinely good guys. And funny fact is, like, they sort of work the Southern tag style now. Just to laugh in the face of the critics.
Yeah. Well, same thing with, I am on the FTR train now too. I thought they were kind of disappointing at first in
AEW. Oh yeah, now they're like.
Yeah.
Next level.
Well, I guess sort of like what I was going to say is one thing about the evolution of my fandom is like when I would have been, you know, 15 to 20 or something like that, I would have been like, and I kept... It's contradictory, right? But I'm like, man, if I had a promotion, it would look like rings or something. But yeah. As I get older, I appreciate the spectacle of pro wrestling more. Not that doesn't mean like sports entertainment, you know.
Or, right, right.
It's but I
pro wrestling.
Right. Which is like, for example, I love Jade Cargill.
Right, right.
I'm a huge fan. And I just like love everything about it. The character, the spectacle, like the relationship with Smart Mark and everything like that. Like that's just a lot of fun. Right.
Right.
And that's probably something I wouldn't have been into. Like that's something I wouldn't have been into 20 years ago.
There's a lot of spectacle of pro wrestling that I love.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily sports entertainment. Like the box, are prime example A of like the sport, like the, example of pro wrestling I love because they go in there, put full maximum effort, and they're entertaining while doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it, and wrestling's supposed to be absurd sometimes. I get it, but not too absurd.
Well, there's a fine line because I'm not really into Danhausen or Orange Cassidy.
Orange Cassidy, no.
But I would watch any Kikutaro match.
True, Kikutaro doing the suplex then.
Yeah, like exactly. There wasn't a lot of the comedy stuff in maybe on the indies, but like. The comedy was different in North America. And in some ways, I think the Kikutaros and the Osaka Pros and Stalker Ishikawa have had some kind of influence on comedy in North American pro wrestling subsequently. But to me, that would be my preferred type of comedy in wrestling.
Stalker has at least one thing in every one of his matches that make you laugh out loud. Yeah. I don't know how he does it.
It's like, you could argue like he has like one of the greatest, not just the greatest comedy wrestler, but like one of the greatest like ring psychologists.
Yeah.
If you can make people laugh like that every time. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think that's credit for like, because people think of psychology differently than comedy, but I think there's a huge part of psychology to that, right? Because I'm sure like, you know, a good comedy wrestler, I would assume, I don't know what goes through their heads, but obviously sometimes they come out planned, like Kikutaro would dress up like Stan Hansen or something.
Right.
But clearly they will do stuff. They clearly must read the crowd sometimes to come up with stuff, right? In the moment.
Right.
You know? So.
I just think it's a marvel of, not too much comedy, but
right.
Comedy that makes it right.
Yeah. And that's one of my problems. I would put that probably on my list of things I don't like about AEW is the comedy sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
I like 2.0.
That's one I think
so. 2.0 is great.
Yeah, 2.0 and Daniel Garcia are phenomenal.
Are great. But the Orange and Danhausen, I'm not so big on.
Yeah, I'm not so big on that kind of stuff. But people would call us stuff.
Yeah, or like just like, you know, I like the Acclaimed.
Yes.
And I like Ricky Stark's humor because it's very like understated and subtle,
and it's dark.
Yeah,
it's a little dark too,
like when he called Swerve and Keith Lee like it was like Dollar Star Keenan and Cowles.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And stuff like that. Like funny lines and promos that I love and stuff like that, right?
Small little zingers, but not like the whole act.
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, but and most of the I think my other criticism of AEW would just be like certain stylistical choices.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a lot of debate this week about the TNT title changes.
Oh yeah,
I don't have an issue with a mid-card title going hot potato. Sometimes that just doesn't bother me.
But then the way they were perceiving it at first, it was like it's going to be an equal title, and I'm like,
right, equal. But it never was. It never was, and it's like never was. Rampage was going to be more than a B show. I mean, he debuted Punk on there, right?
Right.
And he's been beefing them up in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
But it was always clearly like a B show other than that. Right. Although I like it. It's like quite possibly the easiest wrestling show to watch.
No, it is the easiest wrestling show to watch. I was there on Wednesday.
Right. Yep.
I was like, this is just so easy. It's like the tape, even like the tapings, and you know, wrestling tapings suck.
Yeah.
Like
I've never been to a wrestling taping, actually.
AEW makes it easy to watch because there's always something going on. It doesn't make you think, oh, I'm at a taping.
Yeah.
Like the Raw, SmackDown, it makes you think you're at a taping.
I've never been to a WWE show.
Ooh.
And I don't think I will be at this point because it's like. No,
and not at this point.
Why? Yeah. Like, I flirted with the idea of going to a house show I have, but not I never pulled the trigger. Not these days anyway. Like a couple of years ago, there would have been enough talent possibly to justify it.
Yeah, but there's not enough talent to justify doing
some of the talent now. No.
And he just released a bunch of other talent yesterday. I'm like,
yeah.
Like, bruh. Yeah, it's just so. But the state of All Japan and Noah, what would you call it?
Well, let's start with Noah because it's the hot it's the hot topic. And I stayed up till 7 a.m. this morning watching Noah. Because it was like a 4-hour show or 4.5-hour show or whatever. It was a good show.
It was a good show.
It was a good show, but I mean, you could get frustrated watching it, absolutely. So
I think that's been the story of pro wrestling over the past few years. It's like good aspects of the show, but frustrating.
I think it's more so the story since Muto won the title.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I would date it to.
So 2 years.
He would have won that title in February 01.
21.
Yeah. That would make now going back to Muto in February 2001. Well, let me tell you.
February 2001, he was facing Genichiro Tenryu. And
yeah.
Boy, those matches were a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. The Tenryu Muto, there's a Tenryu Muto match from June 2001 that would absolutely probably be in my top five, maybe.
Yeah.
But so anyway, getting back to that, you know, I mean, the old guys had been there since Cyber Agent bought the company, I guess, in early 2020. And so they were all there through the early days of the pandemic and everything like that.
Right.
And that was fine. Like, I don't mind old guys on the card, depending on where you put them and whatever. But then, you know, Muto started geeking out Kiyomiya. Fine, whatever. But because Go was having this incredible run as the champ, and then Muto wins the title and everything starts falling apart because they start putting on the tag titles and the national title on old guys too, right?
Right.
And all of the heavyweight titles in Noah are held by, what was it? So there's four champions between the two singles titles and the tag titles. Three out of the four are over 50 and one is over 40, which is Hideki Suzuki is only like 41 or 42.
And he just got released from the E.
Yeah. And he's refusing to do jobs to one of their top guys in Nakajima. So
what?
Yeah. Cause they had a tag title match where Sugera and Suzuki beat Kenno and Nakajima.
Oh, I did read that.
And they did the thing on like a Korakuen a couple weeks ago where it's like each guy has a singles match against the other.
Right.
To build it up. So there's a Sugera versus Kenno match and a Nakajima versus Suzuki match. And so Sugera beats Kenno, but Suzuki and Nakajima went to a 30-minute draw. And it turns out that Nakajima was supposed to win, but Hideki said no, which is the second time that they've had a 30-minute draw, actually, because they had one in early February of 2020, I think. It was a great match. Like, don't get me wrong. Like,
it was really in WWE.
The Suzuki discourse, I should clarify myself. I think he's an excellent professional wrestler. I've given Hideki Suzuki match 5 stars. I know that there are people who don't like the style, which is fine. I get that. But my issue with Hideki Suzuki, because people get very protective of him, is that he's clearly a problem in the locker room. Companies have tried to use him before, both Big Japan and Wrestle One, made them their champion to like eventually put over their guys. And he sort of stiffed and wind suffered Daichi Hashimoto, who was, you know, Big Japan was trying to make him into their star. And that, well, Daichi kind of eventually got good, but the timing was such that, you know, Hideki sort of putting him over technically, but not really selling like he put him over type thing hurts him in that kind of thing. And he doesn't really draw. you know, there's no evidence of him, at least anything bigger than Corrick and Hall. Now, people are blaming Nosawa, which is legitimate. These are his friends, like Muto. Muto gave Nosawa his first like regular contracted gig because he was just an indie slummer, and then Muto brought him into All Japan in the mid 2000s. And he's friends with like your Seguras and the Shooters, Masakatsu Funaki and Hideki, and obviously. And so this work gets a little more complicated because I'm not letting off Nosawa off the hook, but it's abundantly clear that Cyber Agent, who has clearly putting a lot of money into this because they've signed all these old guys, and because they signed Muto to a 2-year contract, and they're bringing in Kaz Fujita, and they brought in all of these foreigners. We can discuss some of the choices of foreigners later.
Oh yeah,
but they're spending money. They're spending money, and the reports are they got freaked out because the January Budokan did 1,000 less than the Go Muto Budokan in February 2021. So there's clearly directives of they got to draw in big buildings. They're running the Budokan again in July, and then. Again, in January 2023, they just ran two nights at Sumo Hall. They drew 1585 for an all junior show, and then only 2077 for the last night show. And DDT Judgment in March drew 2500.
That's telling you something right there.
Yep. Now, mind you, it was the 25th anniversary DDT show, so that might be a bit of a...
That's probably why.
Yeah, but it's still sort of questionable on that one, right? Because I don't really pay attention to pandemic numbers. There's certain trends that I think you can still pull. Like if all of a sudden companies start doing even worse than they were.
Oh yeah.
Earlier
yeah,
in the pandemic,
pull that trend out.
And I think Stardom has grown. I don't think that's undeniable. And Noah was growing. So I think you can like New Japan is really hard to say. I think that's a little more complicated.
I think the clap crowds and everything.
Yeah,
and just like zone out buildings.
And yeah, they're running extremely large buildings that have I don't know what the capacity rules are. They keep changing and they're different in different prefectures too.
Right.
So New Japan's a little hard to get a radar a read on, but you can tell, you could just even go by 2019 pre-pandemic numbers for some of those. Like Stardom has had their biggest shows attendance wise during the pandemic. They were never drawing some of those house sizes in 2019. Now I've seen some people say there's papering involved. I don't know how accurate that is or not. But anyway, so yeah, that's the sort of the business situation. There's a lot of pressure to deliver on this. So that's sort of, you know, I don't want to absolve Nosawa completely because some of his harebrained ideas are truly crazy in terms of pushing the old guys, but there is that pressure of you got to fill up Budokan, you got to fill up Sumo Hall. That's not helping, I think. And Nakajima might be toast as a main eventer. I mean, I don't think that's impossible to say.
That's not impossible, my God.
That's not impossible. I think they still have plans for Kaito Kiyomiya, I think, but he keeps losing and losing and losing the big ones. I like what they're doing. This seems strange to say, but I think the junior division's actually gotten better, which has been a point of debate because of some of the booking and the goofiness, but they're actually paying attention to it and they're letting them run their own all junior shows. They're working with Dragon Gate. That's good. But I mean, some of the booking is frustrating. Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't, like, I don't understand, like, it's funny because Meltzer talks about this in regards to AEW. It's like, well, look, you gotta get a certain rating on TNT with using the Jerichos, but you also need time to put Dante Martin on TV because 5 years from now, you need Dante Martin or Yuta or whoever to draw ratings for you. and you know, Jericho, you know, might not be wrestling or whoever, right?
Years from now, yep.
Yeah. So that's the balancing act. And I think, you know, for the most part, Tony is mostly getting that. I would say there's some start stops on some younger people in AEW that is weird.
Oh yeah, there are some start stops. Yeah.
On the like the younger ones, like you know, what happened to Dante Martin, especially now that Darius is out again.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, shouldn't you be using him like you were just a couple months ago and that kind of thing? But anyway, like comparing that, but mostly Tony is getting it right. You know, he's look at what he's done.
Nosawa's not. And then,
but Nosawa doesn't have that balance at all.
No.
And they've got younger guys like Yoshiki Inamura and Kenny Okada, who are both turning 30 later this year. And they're still basically job guys.
That sucks.
And they don't have any young heavyweight talent in other than Kaito in their mid or early 20s.
Oh, wow.
So there's that's a big problem.
And then All Japan sort of similar in the situation.
Well, yes and no. I will get a little more defensive of All Japan because I think it bottomed out in 2020, I would say.
Right.
From lack of interest, because Kento Miyahara was no longer the Triple Crown champion. And what they did was they I think Miyahara was losing the title when he did, but I didn't think Suwama was going to have the reign as long as he did, but they did because of the pandemic to basically, you know, what does it matter who our champion is?
Right.
Under these circumstances, because this is like really early on when it was still, they were taping in empty arenas and stuff like that. Right. So it doesn't really matter who the champion is. And so a lot of people turned off. I would defend, and I like it was a little depressing to watch at times, but I don't think some people claim it's the worst company in Japan, and I don't buy that at all.
Oh no,
I'm not gonna come here and defend it and say, well, actually there was a 4.5-star match. No, it's not that they were, well, they've had 4.5-star matches, but they're not having as many as they were, you know, three, four years ago. That's for sure.
3-4 years ago.
Yeah, like 2018, 2019 really was their last peak, I'd say. But they're not
we
the worst.
We really company. Want to say who the worst company is in Japan is Wrestle One. Just kidding. They closed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's funny because I was thinking about this. Like, what is the worst company in Japan? Like, there's some pretty indies that are sort of hard to watch sometimes. But there's a certain baseline level of talent in Japan where like even an indie does not get as bad as a U.S. indie. It doesn't even get as bad as a certain larger indies as well, right? I'm not going to name names.
We're GCW. Not going to name names.
No, I mean, I respect what GCW has done. This is just an aside. Like, because this is another aside. I care about like the business of wrestling and read about the business more than I would have used to, because it's sort of fascinating to me now. And one of the things is in GCW, it's like, okay, well, they're drawing. I think they might've peaked.
Oh yeah, they definitely peaked.
Although I don't think their crowds have fallen off. Like I saw some people expect after Hammerstein. They're still doing decently.
Yeah, they're considered. Still doing well. I still think
I am not confident in their long-term success.
No.
Right. And so, which is sort of gets to my another point is I've seen good GCW shows and I've seen good matches, but consistency is not their strong point, and I've seen some horrible things. But what sort of gets me to the point is, like, I've seen people complain that certain GCW regulars get booked on their favorite indie because, you know, because they don't like GCW and because they think these wrestlers suck, which fine, they're not all great wrestlers, but it's just like, I don't understand what you expect in your local indie not to book the hottest independent wrestlers that are highlighted in the hottest independent promotion in the country.
Right.
Right. Like, who are you?
Called you can't business.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Now, you could do stupid things with big stars that ended up killing your business.
You know, too. Do like pro wrestling, Noah.
Yeah. But it's just like, I cannot complain when you book, I don't know, top GCW names on your local indie. It just doesn't bother me at all. Like, or, you know, I mean, no one's booking GCW people up here in Canada regularly or anything. But the point is, I would have no issue with that. Like, you know, It just doesn't make sense to me. Like, what do you expect these people to do?
Right. Then you're supposed to book top guys.
Yeah.
You're super indie. You're supposed to book.
So anyway, back to All Japan. I think they bottomed out, but slowly they're getting better. I think they put the title back on Kento. And he immediately, like I said, you can tell certain things, even in the pandemic numbers, you can clearly see that they have done some better numbers since Kento got the belt back within, pandemic parameters. They never stopped turning out rookies out of their dojo, which I think is a very important part of any Japanese company. And there's some legitimately strong talent that they have, that's young, that still has to be developed. The booking has gotten better. I mean, it's funny because I have this long running thing where I like take pot shots at Tajiri in my reviews at Voices of Wrestling.
Right.
And you know, it's funny because a day or two ago, Tajiri put out a tweet in Japanese complaining that people will say, like, he's killed every promotion he's ever worked for, which is kind of true. He had Smash. And he had Wrestling New Classic that both went belly up. And then after Wrestling New Classic went belly up, he went to Wrestle One. And then he left Wrestle One before it went under, but it was clearly in free fall when he was there briefly.
Yeah.
Which is funny.
Let alone ECW.
Yeah. So
well, that was not Tajiri's fault.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he's got sort of this, and I mean, he's obviously like a shell of what he was in the ring. And that too. So it's just sort of annoying to see him. And you can tell there are certain booking decisions that were made at his whim. Like giving Super Crazy a brief run with the junior title.
What?
Yeah, this happened in like December.
Oh, December.
And then in January, Super Crazy goes to Noah.
So of course funny. He does.
Yeah.
Power play.
I'm not sure if he was actually headhunted or there was some sort of agreement that he works like a month or two in All Japan and then goes to Noah. I actually suspect it's the latter.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because he dropped the title and everything cleanly and everything like that.
Oh, so he did the honorable thing.
Yeah. So I it was just a short thing and then Noah gets him, right? Anyway, the point is, I guess, you know, Tajiri seems to be, well, we think it's Tajiri and Shuji Ishikawa booking the company. That is sort of the thing. And the reports are like, there are some people disgruntled backstage with Tajiri. Some others are not. He's popular among the ex-Wrestle One guys. Apparently, which is, and, you know, there's the frustration over the Shotaro Ishino push. Because he comes in there and it feels so hot and it shakes everything up. And then he just does a couple of jobs and Triple Crown title matches. And that was pretty deflating for me. And I think a lot of people got pissed, but here's the thing. And I'm not trying to say, oh, but they handled him perfectly or anything like that. But there's some dubious questions of like how much of a draw he actually is. Right. And that's just the way it is. Do I think they could have done a better job with him? Absolutely. I mean, they're doing a better job now, but it was a case of breaking him down before they built him back up, which I'm not sure was necessarily had to have been done the way it was, but I don't know. I don't know if you can really make the case that he should have won the Triple Crown as soon as he came in there, like some people were saying. But that is not me making excuses for a lot of the other booking decisions from about July 2020 or June 2020 when he came in till about, oh, I don't know, January this year or so, or maybe a little earlier, late last year. It was like a year and a half of some not so great stuff.
Champion Carnival still going on?
The finals are on Wednesday.
Ooh. Who is in the final?
So in the finals, we have, it'll be Jake Lee versus Yuma Aoyagi.
Oh, that's a sort of an unpredictable one there.
So yeah, I have a prediction, but I'll say this is the first fight. Like, to tell you the one of the problems with the company is this is the first Champion Carnival final since 2017 not to feature Kento Miyahara.
Axe.
Right. I mean, he is so far and away like the biggest drawn star in the company. Is like, well, you know, like I said, it's like the balancing act, right? He's the only guy who can fill your buildings, but you got to make new ones. So Jake Lee won the Champion Carnival and the Triple Crown for the first time last year. He turned heel to do it and like made his old heel faction out of sort of the ashes of Enfance Terrible from Wrestle One. And they did the double turn and Shotaro Shino turned face. Jake Lee is a very good professional wrestler in the ring, but he just doesn't play a very good heel. There's flashes of like times where I say, oh, looks like he's turning a corner and he's really feeling comfortable as a heel. And then the next show, I'm like, oh, fuck this, you know?
Yeah.
So I think at this point, it's just been too inconsistent. And we're like a little over a year into this heel run. And I think that's at that point, it's safe to say, I'm not sure he's ever going to get it, or at least not fast enough that he needs it.
Right.
Now, he had to vacate the title because he broke his orbital bone back in late December.
The Joel Embiid injury.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm a Sixers fan. I'm sorry. I had to rub that in your
face. Yeah, I know. It's fine. I wasn't expecting much. And I think, frankly, going to six games was more than I was expecting.
If they won on Thursday, I thought you guys were going to win the series.
Yeah, maybe. But I just didn't have that sort of expectation, so I did not take it very hard. Definitely.
Oh, good. I took the Kawhi shot very hard, and I had to watch it for an hour. That's why we were punishment for a poker game.
Yeah,
and it was not fun watching that shot for an hour straight, quadruple doink into the basket.
God, yeah. Anyway, so with Jake Lee, it's like, he has a lot of the tools. He's got the size. He's got the look. Like, he's got your like idol right. Look, good looking guy. Nice flow, nice hair.
Oh, I thought Jake Lee was bald.
No.
What was I thinking of? I was thinking of Vegeta. I thought Jake Lee looked like Vegeta.
So he didn't happen, but I think he's still winning the Champion Carnival because, okay, you give him back-to-back Champion Carnival wins. No one's done that since Minoru Suzuki did in 2009-2010. So because you need to keep him as a main eventer for one thing, but the rest of the time, there's clearly like other younger guys that they could keep elevating. Like Yuma Aoyagi is incredible. I would argue that he's one of the 20 best wrestlers in the world.
Yeah, he was a good junior for them, right? He was their junior.
No, he was never junior champ. I mean, he was a junior. No. He was a junior for a couple of years, like the beginning of his career.
Okay. That's what I was thinking of.
He's got a younger brother younger brother. Okay. His younger brother is being groomed to be the junior ace, though. Aoyagi.
Aoyagi, okay.
His younger brother, who debuted in January 2019, and he's clearly junior sized. He'll never move up. He's being groomed to be the junior ace, and he's very good, like high flyer type thing.
I haven't watched All Japan in such a long time. Yeah. So I get confused.
So we're in a problem where there's a couple of old guys like Ishikawa and Suwama. There's Kento. There's Jake Lee, who hasn't turned out like they clearly have expected. And there's Yuma, but there's like, no one else is ready. I mean, there could be guys that could be in a couple of years,
but they're not ready now.
Yeah. So I think there's actually some long-term hope, but booking stuff for a while until these people are ready, it could get a little tricky, I think.
Yeah, that could. Yeah, that's always tricky with wrestling, no matter who.
But my point is like, look, take a look at some of the things. If you were watching in 2019,
yeah, I was.
Give the Champion Carnival a look.
Yeah, it looks like a good carnival, honestly.
Yeah.
So, any highly suggested matches from the Champion Carnival this year?
Yeah, I've got a few. I would watch just a couple of days ago on the 29th, Yuma Aoyagi versus Kento Miyahara, 30-minute draw.
Ooh.
which is like, I complained about the booking before, but the booking is getting better, right? And this was like one of those examples of it. They booked it so Yuma gets into the finals by only getting a draw, right? And Kento and Yuma have been on and again, off again tag team partners. So this match was building some more tension. And like, I think they're running the Budokan for their 50th anniversary show in which seems kind of crazy in the size of the company, but in September. And I think the main event's going to be Yuma versus Kento, right? So if it is, and I don't see, there's no other main event they could do unless they bring in a big outsider for Kento to face. But the biggest match they can do in the company is Kento versus Yuma for the Triple Crown. So I think that's, to me, the way that this was built. And like in the course of the match, why I love the match so much is like, you can see it, like their like relationships beginning to get more tense again, right? Because there's the rivalry, because Kento's a champ, but Yuma is like, he's only 25 and he's actually quite incredible. Really? Yeah. For his age. So it's like the situation of like this guy that's can no longer be in Kento's shadow anymore and that sort of thing. And they start like really like taking a look into each other. So that's a really good 30-minute draw, right? Because it's like the ending is so great because he gets him up. Like Yuma hits his, like, it's called the Rockstar Buster, which is one of his finishers, which is like a fisherman's buster, right? And as soon as he hits it, the time expires, right? So it's like, well, great, could timing. He be pinned him? If he had like the time hadn't run out, right? Because he's never pinned Kento in a single, or Miyahara, yeah, in a singles match, but in a tag match, in the undercard of the show before that, they face each other. Yuma got his first ever direct pinfall over Kento in a tag match, right? So they're like building up to it and up to it. Like he rolled him up with a flash pin. They go to the 30-minute draw. All the other times they faced each other, Kento had won. So it's like, okay, there's some actually good booking going on right now.
Right.
And for the rest of the tournament, I would recommend Takuya Nomura versus Kento Miyahara, Takuya Nomura versus Yuma Aoyagi, and Takuya Nomura versus Suwama, which is awesome. Because Suwama fucking like destroys him.
Suwama murders him. It's a basic Suwama match.
Gave him a giant shiner. People. Give him with some nasty looking lariats. Other good matches, Shuji Ishikawa versus Shigehiro Irie was a really good match. And
I'm curious what Irie does in All Japan.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a freelancer, but they use him a good amount. And I think he's been good in the mid-card to help the company, right? And I would also recommend, I'll give you a warning, it's a 30-minute draw, but I really enjoyed it. T-Hawk versus Shigehiro Irie.
Oh.
But it goes 30 minutes. Like the middle is a little bit. But I thought the rest of the match was really good. Yeah. So here's the thing. I have out of the whole, okay, so the blocks are done. I had 2 4-star matches and 1 4.25 matches.
All right.
But I had nothing below 2. So this is like the king of the 3.5. But I don't have anything below 2.75. And that was like Yoshitatsu.
Easy watch.
Right? Very easy watch, right? Not high end. Although, I mean, they should start trying to get back into it. Because they were never, like the bottom to the top of the card was never high end even in 2018, 2019.
No.
But the top of the card was very high end, higher end than it is now. So I think hopefully with Kento back as champ, we can get to that.
Yeah.
I think, look, if this was 3 years ago, well, I don't want to say that because Yuma's gotten so much better. But the Jake Lee of even 3 years ago and the Yuma Aoyagi of today could have a 4.5-star match. But here's the thing. What's dragging Jake down is his character work, right? He tries to be... Like he has this ridiculous, like evil scientist laugh that he does. And he does all these weird, like arm and hand motions and stuff. And like, if he cuts the crap and just tries to kick the shit out of Aoyagi, it could be an incredible match, but I'm a little worried about how it turns out, because if Jake just goes into like melodramatic supervillain mode,
Yeah. Plugs for you.
Yeah. I mean, the big plug is you can read all my stuff on Voices of Wrestling. I have covered the every Champion Carnival show. I didn't have time to do review of the Noah Jr. show, but I've got a match review of the yesterday's Noah show with all sorts of craziness and lots of old men doing things. You can follow the show on Twitter at Emerald Flow Show, all one word. And we come out every other week. We don't have like a set day because things happen. We're probably not going to record until after Wednesday. We'll have an episode coming out later next week, like Thursday or Friday, because the Champion Carnival finals are on Wednesday and there's no point in skipping that show and waiting. So just wait to record and everything like that. So I host that with Paul Vosch, also of Voices of Wrestling. Oh, Danny, I can't hear you.
Paul,
I can hear you now.
Paul's a good guy, so.
He is, yes.
No, sorry for the, I put my earphones in for a second.
Yeah.
But then the mic wasn't working.
So. Yeah, I'm probably going to go and grab a few groceries, and then I'm just going to watch wrestling all night because there's a lot going on tonight.
Right. Thank you, Gerard, for joining me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Danny.